John Freeman, in your book, you take us through 4,000 years of human communication, and then you talk about the dangers of the internet. What is it about the internet that particularly worries you?
Well, if you look at the first 4,000 years of communication, people were writing slowly. They expected responses slowly. They didn't have electronics attached to them. So even with the telegram, people didn't get it every day. They didn't get it instantly. It was a big deal when it came. But suddenly now we're all connected on this network, which existed through postal services and through the telegram, but instantly. And so we're more connected than ever before. And people can't keep up with the amount of communication that we have. And it distracts us. And it also leads us to do bad things.
Like what?
Well, you respond instantly. And before you even think, it's gone. While we're talking, we can make eye contact and I can see your face change as I say something, whether it's appropriate or not. But when you type on a screen and you send it, there's no visual cues, there's no body language, there's nothing to tell you that what you're about to say may or may not be appropriate. And so people say things that they wouldn't say elsewhere.
So the etiquette of the net is a problem.
There needs to be a super ego on top of your computer, judging whatever you're about to say.
And you write that email and the internet leave you with no context. What's the problem with that?
Well, you know, if you think about life, experience is what gives you wisdom. It allows you to make decisions based on what means something to you, what your values are. And if you operate in a context of no context, you're constantly reacting. And it means that there's no continuity to either your life or your correspondence or your work. And a lot of times to make a good decision about what you're going to do in the office, you need a broader context. And we're not working that way anymore. We're working instant responses, huge amounts of email coming in, and you just have to reply quickly to get them out the door.
You seem to suggest that internet communications are more addictive than previous technologies. Were you an email addict?
Oh yeah, I'm still in my 10-step program, you know. I mean, and I fall off the wagon occasionally, and I find myself emailing late at night or in the morning, or you know, three emails at once, and I have to sort of step back because, unlike mail, you know, no one walked to their mailbox to check it 200 times a day. No one was going to the telegraph office 200 times a day. But we're doing that with email, and we're also doing it even though our computer is set up to check our email every 25 seconds sometimes. And it goes back to the way that people are conditioned to use slot machines. You give a reward only some of the time, and people do the action more and more frequently because they know that simply doing the action a lot gets them the response they need. And for us, that's getting an email that makes us feel we're needed and wanted.
And yet time condensing, cheaper, more succinct and impersonal communication didn't begin with the internet. I mean, these concerns have been raised about technologies for centuries.
Yeah.
Are you just a sort of nostalgic, book-loving, sort of peering back at the pre-internet age through rose-coloured glasses type person?
Well, let me take the pipe out of my mouth and unbutton my tweed jacket and answer that question. No, I mean, basically, every form of written communication has created a response of anxiety and stress and a discussion over whether we're simply writing too much or too connected. But the difference here is, as I said, with the post office, with the postcard, with Telegram, people were connected, but not really nearly at the volume at which we're connected now. For example, I mean, Americans in the heyday of the postcard were buying one a week, and that caused a sensation. Now we're sending an email, you know, once every 10 minutes. Telegrams, at the great height of the telegram, people were sending, you know, a few a year. Most of the telegrams were for business or for the news. News traveled over the telegram. It's what made the newspapers great. But now we're checking our email. We're sending and receiving email 200 times a day. It's taking up 40% of our day, at least in North America. People are checking it in the bath. No one sent telegrams from the bathtub. No one sent telegrams from the toilet, which people do with email all the time. There's something really kind of out of control about it. And as wonderful as it feels, it's breaking up our attention span and it's breaking up the 8-hour workday.
What about the claims that social media sites in particular have brought back human interconnectedness? They've relaunched the old fashioned sense of community with a sort of cyberspace town hall meeting. I mean, President Barack Obama certainly made a lot of that in his presidential campaign.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are some wonderful things about social media, Facebook, Twitter, all the ways that you can get in touch with people, you know, across the entire spectrum of your life. And it's very good for political organizing. But if you notice with Obama's campaign, you can't simply use social media and not have real world events. And the problem that I'm writing about in my book is not so much using social media, using email. It's just using those to the exclusion of other real world things like sending a postcard or a letter or walking down the hall and touching your coworker and saying, hey, we got to do this. you know, so basically those things are very useful, but only in the context of the entire world and the tangible world. Because if you pretend like the virtual world is the only world, which is the way that we seem to be going, you'll find yourself quite alone.
Yes, you write about the internet being the first technology to really tie us to a machine. But is it any worse than, say, Lincoln and his telegraph on the Civil War battlefields? I mean, at least today's technologies are mobile.
Well, Lincoln was the president. He was, directing a country in a bloody, terrible civil war and one of the most stressful times in American life. But we're not all presidents. We're not all EMT workers. We're not all bankers. And yet we live as if our lives require that amount of connection and broadcast capability. I mean, we all now have the capabilities of old world media empires. We can send out ticker tapes on Facebook. We can tweet 1,200 of our closest friends. I mean, every thought that we have now is the potential kind of news story. And that's a very different thing than simply, Lincoln using the telegram, because in many ways, our world leaders should be that connected. But if you look at the way that Barack Obama operates. Yes, he was the first BlackBerry president. Yes, he did use social networking, but he wasn't receiving all those messages himself. They were sifted and sifted and sifted until he finally, got a few emails a day from his advisors. But we're trying to live that way without any advisors.
Well, let's look at some of those old world, as you call them, technologies. Let's look at the telegram. And there's a technology that allowed dramatically faster one-on-one contact and required brevity of language, and it was cheap. And one of the most interesting stories in your book is about the role of the telegram in the creation of time zones and what you call the invention of now, which I think is something that many of us in the internet age would have thought was our invention. How did that come about?
Well, before the telegram, all time was local. If you took a train from Pennsylvania to California, you had to change your watch 180 some times along the way, because even within certain cities, the idea of what time it was different. And that's because there was no standardized sense of time, there were no time zones, and there was no way to instantly convey what time it was. And the railroad and the telegram expanded at exactly the same time, and the railroad needed standardized times in order for people to arrive on time and get on the train. And so the telegram basically helped create the sense of present tense. And it was enormously useful for scientific research, because you had to be able to have simultaneous observations of a similar event. And, that sense of now was greatly expanded by the fact that telegrams also instantly, once the network was broad enough, started carrying huge amounts of news. So if you were living in New York City, you could suddenly get news from Sydney, which you wouldn't receive for 2 to 3 months prior to the telegram. And suddenly, when you open the newspaper in that period in the mid-19th century, you had to choose from what your sense of now meant. Did you read the local news? Did you read about the murders which happened on East 4th Street? Or did you read about the earthquake in Calcutta? And suddenly, the empathic bandwidth of the human observer had to expand to an enormous degree.
And the postcard, too, it was revolutionary in its own way. It was regarded actually as a crass form of communication, the original sort of multimedia message with pictures and text, and also it was on public view rather than in an envelope. Now, tell us about some of the criticisms levelled at the postcard, including some of the things that we would now associate with the internet.
Well, you mentioned some of them, the brevity, the use of language, the fact that it was public. And, one of the stories that I found in my research was about a woman who was receiving kind of dirty messages through postcard over the mail, and it broke up her marriage in Brooklyn in the late 19th century. And I think there was this feeling that correspondence was not a gentleman's activity, because the more that you look at it, actually women were writing lots and lots of letters. But
God forbid.
Yeah, I know. Look what happens when you leave them alone. They correspond. No, the real thing was the fact that correspondence had forms. There was the thank you letter, there was the familiar letter, there was the love letter, there was the business letter, and there was people who wrote in newspapers giving advice about how to write letters. And then the postcard comes along, and there's no rules for it. And it's similar to email, because email has come along, and there's no etiquette for it. Do you write in caps? Do you use punctuation? Can you check it at dinner tables? People don't know, and so they simply do all of the above.
Also, when the terrestrial mail systems began, you point out that there were complaints about junk mail and the sheer volume of the mail. I loved your quote from the US President Theodore Roosevelt urging restraint and the elimination of useless letter writing. But if so many of the concerns are the same, doesn't that undermine your argument about email and the internet somehow being more threatening to the human condition?
No, because the thing about correspondence is that in many ways we all write our way into existence. It says a lot about who we are and our sense of identity and our manners and our social background. And it's always going to be there's always going to be a sense that needs to be controlled. And the history of written communication involves a great democratization of language, of people's ability to use it, to read it. Going back to biblical texts, originally monks were the only people allowed to read scripture. It was chained to their lecterns. And suddenly, by the time that the colonies and especially America was coming around, people could read the word of God themselves. And so as countries get literacy, more and more people can write. As the postal system develops, more and more people can communicate. And there is a feeling of, how many people are allowed to do this? How much communication is productive to democracy? But the difference about email is okay, great. Everyone can use it as long as you have a computer, which not everyone has. But the volume is simply too much to handle. It's changing the way that we live. And that's why I wrote this book, is simply to step back and say, look at what this is doing to the way that we live. Do we want to live this way? Do we want to be connected all the time? Does this feel good? Can we send messages that mean something when we're receiving 200 a day? I don't think so. So I'm just saying slow down and find other ways to communicate.
And even though you've given an extensive history of communications, you write that we're at the beginning, not the end of the problem. So where will it end?
I don't know. I mean, that's why I wanted to write this book now, because there are lots of places where people don't have broadband communication. Throughout the African continent, the usage rates of internet are quite low. Literacy is still ramping up. So there are lots of parts of the world which haven't yet got on to the internet in the same way that, many of us in Western societies are. And so the volume and the noise level is going to just increase. And the more that companies put down global footprints and rely on workers who work across several time zones, it's simply going to increase. And, my feeling is that there has to be a conversation now about slowing email down a little bit, because people they can't keep up with it. Workers can't keep up with it. It's leading to stress and kind of breakdowns. And I think it's just in everybody's interest to sort of learn some usage tools as a way to sort of slow it down themselves, because the machine itself is made to go fast.
What's your worst case fear if people don't listen to your warnings?
Well, just that, for example, in this interview, I'd be texting. As you're at every meal, everyone is simply kind of virtually half there, because they're always somewhere else in a virtual network. And you see that a lot at dinner parties, people sort of checking their Facebook or texting friends who aren't there. And it just means that we're sort of always half present. And there's something really intense about being face to face and talking, because you do have all these enormously effective physical cues, ways to communicate, to touch someone's arm, to look at them in the eye, to slow the speed of your voice, to say that what you're saying is actually quite important. And we're not using those. And so instead we're trying to be everywhere at once, and we can't. And we, as humans, I think you look at the Fall of Icarus, that, famous painting, the myths of the Greeks, we always want to transcend our human limits, but we can't. And if you read all those myths, you see what happens to people who try to do that. We're not going to have we're not going to plunge into a briny ocean. Instead, we're just going to have panic attacks in the middle of the night because we can't keep up with our email, or our relationships will kind of dissolve and we'll feel alienated. And it sounds trivial, when you put it in those kind of therapy-like terms, but there are ways that we can make our lives more manageable. And one of them is just slowing down.
John Freeman, thanks very much for joining us.
I'm glad.